The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin Period, the English Situation 1372 to 1373, Part 2. How much Edward III himself contributed to the plans for a military recovery in 1373 is difficult to say, and it may not have really been much. The king was now 60, and the abandonment of the great seaborne expedition in 1372 marked the beginning of his decline into senility. A development which was to have terrible consequences for the conducting of the war, as well as the stability of English politics in the following years. Nominally, the principal officers of the council were now the Chancellor, Sir John Kevett, and the Treasurer, Sir Lord Richard Lord Scrope of Bolton. Kevett was a former royal justice and ineffectual mediocrity who owed his appointment to the need to find a layman to placate the anti-clerical Parliament of 1371. Scrope, who had been promoted on the same occasion, was a much abler man, but was either unable or unwilling to take a grip on the government's financial administration. Access to the king was tightly controlled by a small group of dominant counselors who took responsibility for the conducting of the war, and preeminently the Chamberlain William Latimer, the Steward Sir John Neville, and the king's long-standing diplomatic adviser Sir Richard Sturry. These men all came from the ranks of lesser nobility where the king's administrative household had traditionally been recruited. They were joined in the inner recesses of government by two less conventional figures, Richard Lyons and Alice Piers. Lyons was a London vintner of obscure origins who made a fortune from commodity dealing and money lending. There is some evidence he may have been a Fleming. Lyons owed his influence to his ability to raise large loans in the city at short notice, to his inventive way with money, and the favor of Latimer. He was involved in most aspects of royal finance. He farmed part of the customs revenues. He was the largest of the king's commercial creditors, earning attractive rates for well-secured loans. He acted as the crown's agent for dealing with Italian merchant community in London. He supervised the system of selling licenses to export goods without going through Calais. He also operated a debt brokering business, in the course of which he made large sums of money by buying up ancient unpaid debts of the crown. These debts were acquired at discounts as large as 95% or 99% and then repaid to Lyons in full, presumably by Latimer's direction. Much of the proceeds of these operations went straight into the chamber, where it escaped the audit controls of the Exchequer and passed through the direct control of Latimer, but part of them almost certainly went in the Lyons' pockets. In the nature of things, most of Lyons' activities were carried on in dark corners. Alice Piers, on the other hand, exercised her power with a brazenness that shocked her contemporaries. She had originally come to the king's attention as a lady-in-waiting to Queen Philippa, and at the same time in the early 1360s became his mistress, bearing him three children over the following years. Edward's infatuation with Alice, hitherto comparatively discreet, became notorious in the last 5 years of his life. This was partly because she began to take a prominent part in public ceremonies of the court, which was tactless but not in itself exceptional. What was exceptional by the standards of the past royal mistresses was the determination with which this intelligent and greedy woman used her access to the king to obtain favors for her clients, amass wealth for herself, and advance her own political objectives. In 1376, it was alleged in Parliament that Alice relieved the king's treasury of 2,000 to 3,000 pounds a year. Alice Pears' presence about the king did more than anything else to discredit him in the eyes of his subject. It was also directly related to the declining fortunes of England in the war, as the king progressively withdrew from day-to-day decision-making, and in the words of poet John Gower, quote, abandoned his buckler to seek battle in bed, end of quote. But there was a larger sense in which Edward III's partial retreat from the public life was profoundly damaging to England's fortunes. At the height of his powers, the king's skill in managing his own patronage had been the key to his close relations with the nobility and to the ability to muster support for an onerous war. His inaccessibility in the 1370s and the diversion of royal favor to a small group of self-interested ministers and cronies undermined the political order. Moreover, it meant that there was usually no decisive voice to resolve the doubts and squabbles of those who had day-to-day conduct of affairs. On about the end of 1372, Juan Fernandez Alero returned to England, accompanied by a Portuguese royal clerk, Vasco Dominguez, precentor of Braga Castle. They brought with them the text of the treaty with the Portuguese king and the news that Gaunt's ally was in danger of being conquered by Henry of Trastamara before he could perform it. These reports presented the English government with fresh dilemmas. Some way would have to be found of shoring up the Portuguese kingdom while John of Gaunt fought his way across France. At Westminster, Edward III's ministers were prevailed upon to promise that an army would be sent to Don Fernando's assistance as soon as possible. This decision was made rapidly, probably under pressure from John of Gaunt, and without any real thought for the logistical problems involved. Originally fixed at 1,600 men, the army was placed under the command of one of Gaunt's retainers, Sir Nicholas Tamworth. He was a dependable captain who had begun his career as a freebooter in Burgundy in the 1350s and had been captain of Calais since 1370. His army would probably have enabled Fernando to match the French mercenaries of Henry of Trastamara if it had arrived in time. But there was little chance of that. Winter gales and recruiting problems in England were likely to delay any attempt to ship troops across the Bay of Biscay until May at the earliest. In mid-January 1373, Gaunt sent two emissaries back to Portugal to urge patience and endurance on his ally. Unfortunately, neither Don Fernando nor John of Gaunt anticipated the scale and the speed of Castile's preemptive strike. When the Castilians crossed the Portuguese border in December of 1372, the Portuguese king had made no serious preparations to defend his country. He had conducted the campaign with the greatest possible ineptitude. Having initially resolved to confront the invaders at Coimbra, he changed his mind, abandoned his wife in the citadel, and retreated to the south. There he shut himself into the royal castle of the old Moorish capital of Santarém, overlooking the vast plains north of Lisbon, while his enemies swept past him to attack his capital. By the time that Tamworth received his orders, Henry of Trastamara was already at Lisbon. The city, by far the most considerable in Portugal, dominated the economy of the country by virtue of its newfound marine wealth and its expanding population. But its defenses had not kept pace with its prosperity. The city had been built on terraces on the north side of the Tagus, around the fortified cathedral and Moorish castle of St. George. But the crumbling walls protected only the upper city. The rest was completely open. On February the 23rd, 1373, the Castilian king occupied the lower town without difficulty. 2 weeks later, his admiral, Ambrosio Boncaraga, appeared in the Tagus with the Castilian galley fleet to complete the investment of the city by sea. The population of Lisbon withdrew into the upper town and put up an unexpectedly stout resistance. Don Fernando sent a handful of knights from Santarém to support them, and a modest fleet of 4 galleys and 15 sailing ships under the command of the Admiral of Portugal. But it was an unequal fight. The Castilians threw assault parties against the fragile gates. They brought up stone throwers, which cast giant boulders into the wooden houses and narrow streets. The Portuguese Admiral panicked. He refused to obey an order to attack the Spanish ships before they concentrated beneath the city, lost half of his galleys in a fight, and then left the sailing fleet beached and poorly guarded so that much of it was captured by the enemy. By the beginning of March of 1373, Lisbon was all but lost. Now the sources for this, the Hundred Years' War, the Chronicles by Froissart, the Hundred Years' War by Perrois, the Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and the Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. And ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.